Okay, thank you, Hans, and good morning, everyone. So to end today's board meeting, we have agenda paper 18A on the overview of feedback that we've received on the discussion paper, business combinations, goodwill, disclosures, goodwill, and impairment. The objective of the DP is to explore whether entities can, at a reasonable cost, provide users with more useful information about business combinations that those entities make. The board's preliminary reviews can be classified into three broad categories, being improving the disclosures for business combinations, the subsequent accounting of goodwill, and other related topics. The purpose of today's meeting is to ask if board members need any clarification on the feedback that the staff have highlighted in the high-level summary provided, or if there is any other topic that you would like further details on in future meetings. We thought it might help the discussion if we could first go through each of these three areas and then pick up on any general comments that board members have at the end. So starting with disclosures, the respondents generally agreed that users need better information about business combinations. However, many respondents highlighted practical challenges implementing the preliminary reviews. Feedback on the board's preliminary reviews on disclosures are summarized in paragraphs 27 to 36 of the paper. We would like to know if board members have any comment on those areas.
Mary?
One question observation on this section. Paragraph 22 said the disclosures would help in addressing the too little, too late. And I had some back and forth with some of the staff on this comment before. I think there's both a direct and an indirect trade-off, and the indirect that I wanted to bring out is that I think we've had a lot of evidence that users of financial statements do find impairment information to be relevant, useful information, you know, as a threshold finding from the research that has been done. A personal inference from the data that we've received, not just the academic literature review, but other information, is that some of that usefulness seems to be it's the best and in some cases the only information they get about the subsequent performance of an acquisition, and they know that the impairment test is there as a backstop for if it goes really badly, not according to plan. So to me, the disclosures that we proposed about post-acquisition performance of certain of acquisitions is a more direct response to part of the information needs that users had, the desire for getting information at a minimum about when it goes really badly, which is what impairment covers, but actually more directly and more immediately about both positive and negative. So when you're talking in paragraph 22, I think the staff maybe is a bit more focused on the trade-offs in terms of some disclosures, perhaps whether they compensate or not for possible changes, to some of the impairment approaches. And I want us to think about also articulating the idea of trying to respond more directly to a fundamental and underlying desire of users of financial statements for information about the post-acquisition performance. So it's just an observation that comes out. For me, it was sparked by paragraph 22.
Thank you, Mary. Nick?
Thanks, Hans. Paragraph 27 highlights, I think you described this as mixed feedback on the subsequent performance of business combinations. But in essence, the views seem to be quite polarized here, but mainly between users and preparers. I wonder as we look to take this forward, whether we could draw on some of the evidence that we had from outreach events and meetings, where we asked the extent to which these issues are discussed between investors and management in their meetings. Is the subsequent performance of acquisitions discussed when those two groups either get together publicly or privately? And whether that's a way we could try and see if there's a way forward here on this issue. Thank you.
Tadeo.
Thank you, Hans, and thank you, Dihao, for preparing the paper. I think that the same point that Nick was saying, paragraph 28, in relation to the subsequent performance of the business combination. You mentioned that the respondent said that there are practical challenges that would make it costly to disclose information being considered. Could you please clarify whether these comments are consistent with the results of the field work you mentioned in paragraph 11 to 13?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps I can answer if that helps. We're going to give a bit more flavor in terms of the feedback on disclosures at the next meeting. But to answer that question now, I think the responses from the feedback or the field work did highlight some of those practical challenges, perhaps most notably on the commercial sensitivity point. So it's kind of a cost in terms of disclosing commercial sensitivity information. And we've got some useful examples of what information might be commercially sensitive from that field work, which we'll give in more detail in April.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anne?
Thanks, Hans. I wanted to comment on paragraph 21, which is where we had feedback letters and people challenged the objective of the project, asking why this includes the better information about subsequent performance. And I'd like to comment because I think having clarity around the project objective is really important. It's my memory that the board's work on the disclosure about subsequent performance came out of the initial work on improving the impairment test. So it's very much grounded in the initial work that we did when we realised that there were limitations around the impairment test that we were not going to be able to address. And then we began talking about the subsequent performance of acquisitions. So I just want to, you know, rebut that kind of comment that this area shouldn't be within the project, given that the project was coming out of the PIR of IFRS 3. Thank you.
Françoise.
Yes, thank you for this feedback. I mean, it's inspired me a number of reactions, in fact. One is that we have now, about to publish the revision of the practice statement of management commentary. We have in our PFS project and beyond given guidance, in fact, into what is the boundary of the notes to financial statements. And I think we should rework around the disclosures that have been proposed, where they really belong. And some of them may belong to the financial statements and some may belong to the management commentary. And I think we owe to do that for, and in fact, the consistency in our decisions. I've been surprised by the extent of support for amortization emanating from Europe. And clearly, if I compare...
Sorry, but aren't we going to discuss amortization later on? Or
We will prefer to discuss amortization later.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's fine. It all hangs together, Françoise. That's fine.
But, okay. So I have a second point on the disclosure. Sorry for that. I think it's important to take into consideration the comment emanating from Europe also in particular of the distortion 11 playing field, because this is not something that's going to fade away. I think it's raised very early and I don't think it's going to fade away. Sorry for this one.
Yeah, sure. All right, thank you, Ms. Lanza. Rika.
Thank you, Hans. This is a high-level analysis, but this can show us a very good picture of a whole feedback. So thank you for our staff for excellent analysis for today's discussion. And then I have a similar thought about paragraph 22, Mary already mentioned. So I definitely like to hear a lot more analysis about what type of feedback we received in connection with the question of the too little, too late. And then the paragraph 30, I think I understand the concern of the auditability cannot be resolved by introducing kind of the things like allowing an inclusion of the reference to the management commentary in the financial statement, but still this can reduce the duplication of information, as well as I truly think locating all related issue in the same place might improve the usefulness of the information as a whole. So I think it's very good and helpful for us to consider providing allowance to include a reference to the MC in the financial statement. And another thing about paragraph 34, I truly think enhancement of the information is really inevitable in this project. So I want to ask the staff to explore what the feasibility of the information or what the proper level of disclosure that the entity can provide in practice, as well as that still provides useful information for investors. So I want to hear a lot more about this point in the future meetings. Thank you.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. Just a couple of comments. And first of all, thanks to the project team to summarize all the feedbacks. The first comment is about the project objective. I think as Anne said, that clarifying the objective is so important. And it appears to me when I look at the paragraph, the comments made in the paragraph 22, it seemed that people are regarding the objective of improving, you know, effectiveness of impairment as a contracted objective of provide more useful information. I think when the board explore those solutions, actually, one of the objective is also try to improve the effective of impairment test. We did, I think. For example, headroom approach, updated approach, but it seems that it's not feasible as considering of the cost and the benefit. But so from my point of view, the project objective, we still can have both, even in the future, open. In the meantime, we try to, you know, provide users with more useful information, but in the future, we should still open mind, you know, to improve the effective of impairment test, particularly regarding, I think the later we'll discuss how to improve the level of CGU, which could well be allocated, and how to improve the full, you know, cash flow forecast, something like that. And particularly, I think some stakeholders commented actually provide some solutions, some recommendations how to improve the effectiveness of impairment test. I think that objective is not constructive, you know, contractive to the providing more useful information. Actually, paragraph 22, additional disclosure also mentioned that in some way we can also address how to improve the effective list of impairment tests. So this is the first comment. Second comment on paragraph 25. 25 said that some stakeholders think that the only your unifying objective appears to the cost. For example, some proposal we try to achieve the cost saving, some proposal we maybe will increase the additional cost. But I think from both perspective, when we propose those, you know, proposals, actually we are trying to look at those proposals, whether fits into the objective we identified, not to do trade off the cost, which some proposal will save cost, some proposal will, you know, add additional cost. So I think in the future, I think we the only objective is whether those proposal fits into the project objective, not only fix, you know, focus on only the focus on the cost. And thirdly, about the comments of CODM, I think there are different views for some CODM, some comments that if we focus on CODM, maybe some material, you know, business combination will missing. Some say maybe will resulting in disclose more information. So I think maybe we can look at whether we focus only focus on CODM perspective is a feasible way, or whether we should come back to look at focus on material, you know, business combination information. But this is still consistent with our materiality principle. So this is another comment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jen Chao. Bruce.
Thank you very much, Hans. It's amazing just reading the feedback, and congrats to the staff on summarizing it. You know, to me, whenever I speak to people about this project, it's amazing how many of them just clearly focus in on the impairment versus amortization issue. So it's good to see that at least people are unpacking the other issues. Just a couple of the comments specifically, I think some of them have already been made. The first one was on paragraph 22. I mean, I agree. I'd be very interested in understanding a bit more about how people have seen that these disclosures are addressing it too little, too late. We've touched on it there, but understand a bit more about it, as others have mentioned. My second comment was also on paragraph 32 around the chief operating decision maker. I mean, I guess I saw that as a very practical approach to how we're going to do it. So what I'd be interested in is, have stakeholders given alternatives? So what have they suggested? If that's not an approach to take, what have they come in? And I can see some of the arguments they've made around things like only the significant BizComs, et cetera, but I'd still be conscious to understand, well, do they have different alternatives to what we suggested in terms of that. The last one I was just going to comment on was just on paragraph 34. We talk a bit about the commercial sensitivity. That's a message whenever I've spoken to anybody about this, I'm consistently have got. Everything's about commercial sensitivity. The disclosures are commercially sensitive. People don't want to give them. And also this cost around this issue around the cost and the difficulty of the audit. You know, can we audit it? Is it cost sensitive? I guess in my mind, we need to unpack that, because I wonder if that's just not a standard. Well, whenever we're asking for something new that's requiring a little bit of a forward-looking information, people throw up the audit cost, commercial sensitivity, or these genuine concerns that they're just saying they can't do. And I do think there's a difference between the two, because my worry is that we could be throwing out really good disclosures that have been suggested on the basis that we're just saying, well, they are too commercially sensitive, too costly to give. And I think there's going to be a fine balance. I mean, clearly you can see that's going to be very much a user versus preparer kind of balance in terms of that. So I'm not saying we discount what's been said, but we do just need to make sure we've got the evidence to balance out exactly how that's going to, well, where we come down in terms of those factors.
Okay. Mary, you wanted to come back in?
Yes, I did, because I misheard Dao in terms of the range we were covering here. I wanted to come back to paragraph 32 and something that Bruce and I think before him Jin Zhao had raised. The comment about why focus on CODM, you won't get all material acquisitions, I think signals to me that we have to be very, very clear about what our conclusions and objectives are, and kind of separate that then from the operationalizing that, because I think it was our objective to focus on a non-standard setting term, capture in the requirement to provide monitored information to capture only game-changing acquisitions rather than every material acquisition. So when I look at the feedback that you're summarizing in paragraph 32, I think we have to separate out the question of, is that the right objective, from will the mechanism that we proposed achieve what the objective is? Because if our objective was information about every material acquisition, then I think the comments are, you know, we'd weigh the comments about the risks of using a CODM approach differently than we would if the objective is to capture the game changer acquisitions. And it suggests to me that we maybe didn't put enough of a spotlight on that objective of ours in the discussion paper. And so, you know, to use Bruce's phrase about unpacking the feedback, I think, you know, trying to figure out how we separate out those two aspects would be useful in the follow-up. And it maybe suggests that, you know, as we move forward, we have to think about a way to do the equivalent of flashing lights around the things that are kind of critical decisions about objectives, so that we get feedback specifically on that, and not just kind of all condensed to a reaction to how people take it in. Because about the commercial sensitivity point, maybe we'd have a different weighting of costs and benefits if it relates to a game-changing acquisition than we would if it related to every material acquisition. So that's, I think it's going to become important in terms of evaluating the feedback as well. So, thanks.
Zach? Zach? I think you're on mute.
Finally got me. Right. Managed to make it so far. So I have to think carefully about what Mary just said, because I had a slightly different take. I thought the objective here was to hold management accountable for the capital allocation decisions that they make, of which M&A is the most significant one for many firms. So that's a slightly different line, I think, than Mary just described, and I'm going to have to think about it. But what I really wanted to comment on was Bruce's point, and just chiming in on the commercial sensitivity. I've been involved in a number of discussions around that, and I've heard a few examples of what's considered commercially sensitive. One or two of those I would truly consider commercially sensitive. Several of them I would not find to be commercially sensitive at all. In fact, it's information that as an operator of a business, I could get from any number of bankers within a day of a transaction. So I really would look to the staff to glean what the specific things that respondents are talking about in terms of commercial sensitivity, so we can parse those and figure out if there are some lines we can draw and some guidance we can provide. Where we are really differentiating between commercially sensitive information and information that maybe there just hasn't been enough thought given to what's commercially sensitive and what's in the realm of users of financial statements and auditors already.
Nick.
Thanks, Hans. I just wanted to follow up on Mary's comments regarding paragraph 32, and I agree it's important that we have clarity here. I don't recall us ever making an explicit decision around the criteria being game-changing acquisitions. Perhaps it was implicit in some of our decisions, but I think we just need to take care and make sure that we do have clarity on this point within time. Thank you.
Sue.
Thanks. I was going to resist commenting on this because I'm sure you're bored listening to me talking about CODMs and the deliberations, but Mary's poked me with a stick, so I'm going to have to react. I think it would be interesting to see us all draw a Venn diagram of what we think are material acquisitions and what we think are game-changing acquisitions and where those things do and don't meet. And I don't recall us having a criteria of game-changing either. I think we wanted to make sure the stuff that investors really needed to understand were included. And to me, I never really understood why that wasn't captured appropriately. appropriately by a good application of materiality. So I think it'll be important when we re-deliberate this aspect to really dig into the feedback we got, and I'm really pleased that people focused on it. What do we mean? What do people mean? And how much of this is good or bad application of materiality? Because I'm nervous about what we're saying about materiality if we're implying that that's just a dumping ground. It's meant to be the stuff that really matters. It's meant to be the definition of materiality, right? So I look forward to that reconvening that debate. That was the main point I wanted to make. And also just to reinforce what Bruce said, I think we obviously need to look carefully at the feedback we've got on commercial sensitivity because it's critically important. But also I think we really need to dig into that. And the debate that comes back to my mind, of course, is always one to do with IFRS 9. When we went out with the first lot of expected credit loss proposals for IFRS 9, people came back and vehemently told us that they were not operational. And I've been in so many outreach meetings subsequently where people have said, well, with hindsight, we probably over-egged that a little bit. Now we saw what you did instead. And so I think we just really need to be careful to make sure that there's, you know, robust information behind the comments that people are making, and that we're respectful and we understand valid views, but that we don't get sucked into something which could be, you know, could there's a risk of exaggeration. So I think we need to be careful on the sensitivity feedback.
And what I certainly find a rather weak argument is that these disclosures would be too much forward-looking. I mean, if you look at the impairment test, that's all about forward-looking information, the estimates of future cash flows. And these disclosures would be very useful in judging whether the impairment test is being done carefully enough. So I don't buy that argument, and I think we should make that clear. All right. Please, Dehao, continue.
Okay, thank you, Hans. So the next part is on the subsequent accounting of goodwill. Most respondents agree with the board that it is not feasible to design a new impairment test that is significantly more effective than the existing one. Respondents' view, including that of users, on whether to reintroduce amortization of goodwill remains divided. Feedback on these preliminary reviews is summarized in paragraphs 37 to 45 of the paper. We would like to know if board members have any comments on those areas. Thank you.
Yes, well, as I started wrongly to say earlier, I've been struck by the evolution in thinking that has developed in particular in Europe, and including in the views of users. So I've been struck by that, and I would be happy to understand more about that evolution. And the other thing that I find a bit difficult to deal with is that as you report, most people are calling for convergence, but so many of them want us also to make our decisions on the basis of the evidence we receive and keep the integrity of our work. So it will be difficult to balance, I think, these two recommendations.
Thank you, Françoise. Anne?
Thanks, Hans. My comments on paragraph 42. Françoise just alluded to paragraph 42. This is the one that says most respondents say that convergence with US GAAP was desirable. When you come back to us on this point, can you just give us more information about what that most means? You've told us that most refers to, based on the number of letters that comment on the topic, but I don't know what that base is. So for me to evaluate this comment about most respondents and US GAAP, I need to know how big the base is where you're deriving the most. And I think that's quite important. Equally, it applies to the many who said that our views, you know, shouldn't we should make independent conclusions, not depending on maintaining convergence. So just some more information on that point, please, when you come back. We're certainly hearing these comments about convergence, and it's really important for us to try and understand them better. Thank you.
Rika. Oh, sorry. First, Bruce.
Thanks, Hans. This to me is really one of the most important questions we're going to answer. I mean, to me, this is the fundamental question. A lot of people have been, whenever I've spoken to anybody about this, is where they've really been drawing on. I guess if I had to take a look at a couple of the comments, I mean, I accept we've got all the various comments to talk about what people's response have been. The ones I just want to touch on a bit was in paragraph 41. We talked there that the response did not provide new conceptual arguments, fine, in terms of either retaining or introducing impairment. But then we said that the limitations of the impairment test observed in practice provided new practical evidence that supported reintroduction of amortization. I'd be interested in understanding a bit more about that. So what are these limitations that people are seeing? What have they actually seen in practice? Because I guess this to me comes down to a knife's edge. I mean, if you consider how kind of split that everywhere, every poll I've ever seen, every survey I've ever seen is kind of really coming down very close. And from memory, when the board initially voted on this, it was also relatively close. And given the rotation that's happening in board members as well since that was done, once again, it could come down to very close. So I think it's very, very important for us to understand the nature of what are these things people have seen in practice. And that's what I quite liked about Para 41. What is it that people have seen? They've gone, look, it's not necessarily the fundamental issue. It's just these limitations in terms of how we've practically been doing this that shows that amortization is a better route or is not. So if we could just, I think, unpack a bit more of the stuff in there. My other comment was just echoing what Anne had said around the US, the convergence with US GAAP. I think we just need to understand that one just a little bit more. And I think you're right. What is the population we're talking about here?
Rika.
Thank you, Hans. So I truly think the benefit of converged standard with US GAAP are substantial. Without losing it, really difficult to recognize what the value they are. So to consider maintaining the converged standards about this acquisition accounting, I hope the staff ensure the benefit that the global market obtain now. So maybe it might be need some research outside the comment letters, but I hope we need to carefully look at it in the future. Thank you.
Tom, please, Tom.
Just a couple of quick comments. So on the US GAAP thing, my reading of the set that I looked at is there is wide support for convergence, but the one most of the people I read said that shouldn't be the prime criterion. We should still seek the best accounting, and we have to be principles-based, and it has to suit our constituents. So I encourage us to get a clear view of exactly what that means. And even when we go to do that, how tight will be convergence? And I'm not saying I'm supporting amortization per se, but one of the things as we go forward, a lot of the people who wrote in supporting amortization made the point that there's amortization, a lot of the criticisms are that it's very arbitrary, but that they thought you could probably, if you were thoughtful about it, come up with something more meaningful, whether it was a management approach or some other approach. And so I really want to encourage you to think about if we do look at amortization, are we going to go for just a simple, completely arbitrary thing, or are we going to follow the suggestions or the wishes of many stakeholders that and try and seek something that's more meaningful? And that may even be important as we get down to the US, is when we talk about convergence, not saying they will, but suppose they go to a very arbitrary period and we decide we want something more meaningful, would convergence start trumping? So there are a whole pile of subtleties in this convergence, not just the main issue. And if I heard DeHaal correctly, I think he said to 45. So I'm going to comment ever so briefly on indicators, which is paragraph 43. I hope I'm not misheard. The one thing when I read, a lot of people were very suspicious of indicators, and there's a presumption that there will be less impairment and that they will be less effective. But almost nobody had any evidence, and the US is now using, and we can look to the US for evidence. And the one paper I've seen on this says that people who use the US version of indicators are just as likely to impair as those that don't. And so that runs counter to the presumption that if you have indicators, people will use it in an opportunistic way. And so I think that's something we need to explore and get as much evidence as we can if we go and look at that road.
Okay, Jian Chao.
Thank you, Hans. A couple of comments. First comment about paragraph 41. I have similar comments as Bruce made that I feel a little bit confused what's the meaning of, you know, the limitation of the impairment test observed that provide new evidence, you know, to reintroduce amortization of goodwill. What's the logic behind that? What's the meaning of the limitation of the impairment test? And what kind of suggestion, you know, behind that? I think this is not one way or another. So I think we need, from my point of view, I need more evidence, more logic behind this. And secondly, about the convergence, because some people said that maintaining convergence was more important than adopting a particular accounting model for goodwill. I think I have sympathy for those people raised the convergence issue, but in the end, I think we still needed to look at the project objective. Whatever kind of accounting model we choose, we still needed to, you know, to make that model fit into our project objective. So I, as Anne said, that I think we also need more evidence. And thirdly, about I think I have comments on paragraph 37, and some stakeholders suggest the board develop additional guidance to improve the level at which goodwill is allocated to CGU. As I mentioned before, I think this is also a good idea to improve the effectiveness of CGU. So if I think some stakeholders actually may provide some detailed recommendation. So hopefully in the future paper, the staff could bring forward those detailed recommendations to the board. Thank you.
Tim, I will give you the floor to answer Bruce and Jian Chao. But let me give you an additional question, which I would like to be answered. In 38A, it says that individual users and users group were split in their views. What does that mean? Were they split between individual users and user groups, or also in among these two different groups?
So on there, that's just looking as the community of users. So both individual users and user groups, they were split as a whole community of users of financial statements, is what we meant by that comment.
So that is a bit of a different view from what I've always heard, that almost all users would not be favorable to reintroduction of amortization. So users are split in their views on this.
Yeah, they're much more split between the two.
Yeah. Another conclusion, which I think is new indeed, is that when we came to the conclusion after everything that we studied, that it's not really possible to greatly improve the effectiveness of the impairment test. And that conclusion has also been shared by most of the respondents. And although that is not a new conceptual insight, I think it is a very important new practical insight. But please, why don't you respond to Bruce and Jian Chao?
Well, you've sort of partly done it for me, actually, because in terms of the limitations that were talked about in that particular paragraph, it is really reflecting on the post-implementation review feedback of too little, too late. It's reflecting on the issues around shielding and over-optimism and just a general thought that the impairment test is not working, and also some of those respondents then also reflect on the board's attempts to try to resolve that and not being able to resolve that. We've obviously discussed this extensively within the project, discussed it within the discussion paper, so it's not new in terms of the project and discussion paper, but it's being raised as it's new in the context of the post-implementation review. And I think, and we need to obviously look at the detail a little bit more, but they see it in the context of the post-implementation review. It's a new view, and because the board is asking for new evidence, they see it as this is still new evidence for the board when they're thinking about whether it is right and there is compelling evidence to reintroduce amortization. So that's, I think, the context of those particular comments.
Okay, clear. Thank you. Mary? Oh, sorry, Martin first.
Okay, thanks, Hans. For me, I think in this regard, it was really surprising that it was, because when we developed the DP, it was always said that all users really would prefer impairment-only test and not going back to amortization, because they think, okay, amortization is not any information value. I think this feedback and comment is a little bit different, because, and also the region where I come from in Germany, it was, I think, a big user group which would prefer going back to amortization. And the main reason is because I think they think, okay, the impairment test is not working effectively, and therefore the information value is limited. And therefore, I think this feedback is a little bit different where we draw our conclusion when we decided on our preliminary views. And I think we have to take this into really consideration and maybe better understand why people are thinking that. But I wanted to say, because I think really this feedback is, for me, it can many, many people also where I have taken outreach have said, okay, they want to go back to amortization, others maybe not. I think we have to clarify that question first before we do any other decisions on this project. Because if you improve effectiveness, I think depends on this question. And that was very, I think, in outreach session where I participated, was very clear. People said, yeah, maybe we have to do that, but if we're going back to amortization, it is not so necessary. But if we don't go back, maybe there is a need. And we have to think a little bit more further on that. Simplifications of that, also people said, okay, maybe we're doing that, but it depends on if we're going back to amortization. And therefore, I think we should, when we continue this project, we have to first answering or deciding on this kind of question. Because if we then go to all other questions, and as we have done in the DP, at the end only deciding on going back to amortization, it is very, very difficult to make decisions on a lot of other aspects of this project. Thanks.
Okay, Mary.
I'm going to start with an apology, because even if I'm not emotionally wound up, I feel that a bit of this may sound like a bit of a rant. One observation I have going, and something I feel I should say at least once a quarter, and I haven't said it yet, and March is the end of the quarter, so I'll do it, which is we have to remember that this project is in the context of a follow-up on findings from a PIR. It's not a blank sheet of paper. What do we think is the best, the ultimate answer? And you know, what we're trying to do is decide whether things are sufficiently problematic that we need to undertake standard setting to change requirements, you know, in kind of midstream. Now, I think in some ways, our ability to remain focused on that might have escaped us, because having started this debate, we've got everybody fired up about it. And as we've said all along, it's, you know, everybody is sitting right at the margin in terms of views. So in terms of more productive comments to give to the staff on this, I'm going to go back to the example of that we were just talking about the potential shift in our understanding of user views, whether that's more information about them or user views have changed. What I heard in the discussions that I've been involved in has been users continue to believe that, and I've heard this pretty consistently, that amortization itself does not provide useful information. Also, that users say that impairment does have some information, but users, I can also see that the data that the staff is reporting being consistent with the fact that users say, well, amortization doesn't provide useful information to them, particularly if it's a standardized life or presumptive life, that at a certain point, that balance has less relevance and they'd like it to go away. So I think it's going to be very important when the staff comes back to us with details underlying this, that we get more specificity about exactly what users were saying. Were they saying that amortization has useful information, or were they expressing concern about the build up and perpetual retention of a large number? And so that's my request for digging in and filtering the information a bit. A second comment that I wanted to raise a big picture, and this sounds more radical than it is, but it goes back to something I think Tom was challenging us to do, which is to provide evidence behind assertions. And it's going to sound radical because what I'm challenging us on is convergence and the importance of convergence. And I think it, you know, if anybody says to me, is it useful to have convergence on a major topic of financial reporting with US GAAP, I'd say yes, of course. But let's stop and assess that so we understand where the benefits are, because part of me wonders if some are who are asserting that convergence is important are actually seeing that a different approach could be almost an accounting competitive advantage rather than convergence is important for users of financial statements, you know, in global capital markets. And the reason I raise that challenge here is that business combinations are themselves a non-comparative event. Some companies make many, some companies make few. You know, you might have one very large one that has very different characteristics from from other transactions. So are we just kind of automatically accepting something as a fundamental driver or consideration in this without understanding what aspects of convergence might be most important, particularly to users of financial statements? So that's a comment or a consideration when we go back to looking at comments about convergence. Then a couple of much more specific comments on paragraph 43 and simplifying the impairment test. Item B notes that some concerns about depriving users of useful information currently required. And I guess I just want to know, as the staff comes back with more detailed feedback, whether those views considered or did not consider the expected improvements in disclosure that we were proposing would be introduced about post-acquisition performance, just so I know better how to evaluate that information. And then a comment Dehao, are we covering other topics in paragraph 46 on now?
We are covering that later.
Okay, so I'll hold on that. But maybe, Hans, if you give me just one more minute, I want to agree with something that you were saying about skepticism on forward-looking, the assertion that information is forward-looking. Yes, we should be sensitive to assessing the substance of that, but my sense of everything we were talking about proposing was a disclosure of either what has actually happened with an acquisition in terms of the post-acquisition performance or information about what were your expectations at X date that led you to pay that price. It is not us asking for an entity to disclose what are their current forward-looking expectations for that acquisition. It's information about historical data. What was it that drove pricing, that drove certain terms? So I think we should look at assertions about what is forward-looking with that question in mind. Is it really truly forward-looking information, or is it subsequent disclosure of information that might have been forward-looking at the time, but now is a historical fact of what their expectation was? So thanks for allowing me to go back on that one.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Good points. Nick?
Thanks, Hans. I just wanted to build on Mary's comment about the need for more specific analysis in terms of what's driving users' views, whether or not to amortize. I think one thing that might be worthwhile looking at here is whether there's a geographical prism here that could give us some insight. I certainly feel that there are blocks of users by geography that certainly fit into one camp or another. Thank you.
Rika?
Thank you, Hans. And I just want to build up some point of the Mary's comment, especially about maintaining the converged standard. I think, management decision will be significantly affected by which approach will be taken in individual standards, especially about whether or not or when the entity will acquire the specific business or specific entity outside that company's group. So I think ultimately that affect the investors' decisions as well as other stakeholders' market activities. So I think from that point of view, it's quite important to consider the benefit of the converged, maintaining the converged standard. I understand that it's not the real objective we pursue through the project, but we really need to understand the value of the benefit. Thank you.
Zach.
Thanks. And thanks to the staff for pulling this together. I think I wanted to comment on a nuance I noted in the user feedback, which is that in talking to user groups, I don't think they typically differentiated or separated the proposal on disclosure from the proposal on amortization. And so sort of the more nuanced view of what I heard from users was that a significant group on either side supported impairment or amortization, but then a larger group sat in the middle and basically said, these disclosures that you've proposed would be more beneficial than what we're currently getting under either impairment or if we move to amortization. So we'd be happy with the disclosures. But if we go the way of reviewing or going back to amortization and then nix the proposals for disclosure, you're going to have some very unhappy users who felt like they gave on the cost benefit and received nothing except worse information than what they had before.
Yeah. I think that's a valid point. All right. Behal, are you I think the board is done. Dahao, do you have any other comments to make?
No, so maybe we can proceed on to the next section.
Yeah.
If that's possible.
Yes,
so
go ahead.
On the next session, we would like to discuss the other topics that's included in the discussion paper. Almost all respondents disagree with the board's preliminary review to require entities to present on the statement of financial position and amount representing equity excluding goodwill. Most respondents agree with the board's preliminary review not to include some intangible assets acquired in a business combination into goodwill. However, some respondents commented that the board should consider undertaking a broader scope project on intangible assets as a whole. Feedback on these preliminary reviews are summarized in paragraphs 46 to 49 of the paper. We would like to know if board members have any comment on those areas. Thank you.
Mary, for a quick one.
Dahao, I just wanted to flag a potential interaction with the primary financial statement project. If we're making decisions about indefinite lived versus finite lived intangibles, just if we could ask people to think about the interaction with the aggregation disaggregation criteria, because to me it did start raising the question about whether it's appropriate, you know, or when it is appropriate to aggregate something with an indefinite life with something with a determinable life, and that goes to what level of detail people get in financial statements.
Okay, any other comments? That is not the case. So that brings us to the end of our deliberations for today, and we will continue tomorrow. Thank you very much.